Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you hear the latest on the Fair Oaks Farms animal abuse video. Whole Women's Health will open an abortion clinic in South Bend next week. Mayor Pete Buttigieg speaks out on the police-involved shooting last week. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Professor Larry DeBoer about public school referenda. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. A prosecutor says investigators are looking into whether an animal rights group worker coerced employees at a large Northwest Indiana dairy farm into abuse of young calves that was captured on undercover video. Newton County Prosecutor Jeff Drisky says a witness has corroborated allegations from an abuse suspect that the Animal Recovery Mission employee encouraged the abuse at Fair Oaks Farms. Drisky says detectives will try to interview the group's employee. Animal Recovery Mission founder Richard Colto called the allegation, quote, ridiculous and absurd. He says none of the group's video shows any encouragement of abuse. The farm that's a popular agritourism destination has faced public backlash over the videos released by the group. It's also been the flagship farm for Fairlife Milk, which has been dropped by several grocery chains.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Hammond City Councilman Bob Markovich is dropping his bid to overturn the results of a razor-thin loss in the May 7th Democratic primary. Markovich sued the Lake County Board of Elections and his primary opponents last month, leading to a recount Friday at the County Government Center. A special recount commission determined 9 absentee ballots were improperly submitted and should be tossed out, but the commission was unable to assess which candidates had received those votes. As a result, a special election would have been required in the 6 Hammond precincts where the ballots were cast. An evidentiary hearing scheduled for Monday morning was canceled after Markovich decided not to move forward with his challenge. The 8-term incumbent was, quote, heartbroken over the dilemma, but called primary opponent Katrina Alexander over the weekend to concede. Markovich, who has held his at-large seat since 1987, was not available for comment on Monday. The recount commission is expected to meet this week to certify the results of the election.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Family and community members continue to question the official version of the events of the fatal police shooting of Eric Logan early Sunday morning. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports many are frustrated that Sergeant Ryan O'Neill's body and dash cam camera were not turned on.
City council members, family, and other community leaders held a public discussion at a local radio station and church Tuesday afternoon, where they expressed outrage about the lack of video footage and the transport of Logan to the hospital by police car and not by ambulance. The county prosecutor says body and dashboard cameras are triggered only when officers turn on their emergency lights, travel at a high rate of speed, or manually press a button. Sergeant O'Neill did none of these. Regina Williams Preston was one of the council members there.
No body cam, no dash cam, no kind of cam in this age of technology. That's problematic.
However, she also revealed there may have been at least one camera that was watching.
And so I hear that someone had a phone. Thank God somebody had a phone. And so I look forward to the truth coming out.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg went on community radio Thursday to address the shooting of a black man by a white South Bend police officer. Eric Logan was shot and killed by Sergeant Ryan O'Neill early Sunday morning. O'Neill says Logan threatened him with a knife. Sylvester Williams interviewed Buttigieg on WUBS, a black-owned and operated neighborhood Christian radio station in South Bend. Buttigieg spoke about the incident, the investigation, the police department, and about getting more people from the community involved in advisory positions.
Any mechanism we can come up with that can create more community input and more independent review of that. I'm being honest, though, that I have not figured out exactly what that could look like alongside the Board of Safety. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it. I'm saying we haven't figured out a structure yet.
Buttigieg's campaign schedule has him leaving South Bend Friday for stops in Florida and South Carolina over the weekend. Activists will be at a march planned for 6:30 on Friday evening, starting at the South Bend Police Department.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Anti-abortion activists from across northern Indiana rallied against the opening of a clinic that provides abortions in South Bend on Saturday. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports, about 300 people attended, including Indiana's Attorney General.
During the rally opposing the Whole Women's Health Alliance clinic, Attorney General Curtis Hill told a crowded church that he opposes abortion but would remain objective. Hill recently appealed a federal court order that the state clear a path for the clinic to open despite not being awarded a permit.
My responsibility is to move forward. I'm pro-life, but I recognize that abortion clinics are able to operate in the state of Indiana.
The rally began with guest speakers at St. John the Baptist Church and ended with attendees wielding signs outside the yet-to-be-opened clinic. At the same time across town, pro-choice South Bend organizer Karen Nemus was providing abortion information at the annual South Bend Pride Festival. She said her group's efforts were better spent there than counter-protesting.
I'm not going to change their mind. They're not changing my mind. I don't see that as being a productive use of time or energy.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An abortion clinic in South Bend will open next week without a state license. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Weingart reports that's following an injunction by a federal judge.
Whole Women's Health Alliance has waged a lengthy battle with state regulators over the license and documentation. A federal district court judge ruled May 31st that the clinic can be opened without the license, pending a trial set for next year. Without the license, the clinic is still operating under the same oversight as other medical facilities. The license for abortion clinics is a state requirement. Sharon Lau is the Midwest Advocacy Director for Texas-based Whole Women's Health Alliance. She says without the license, the clinic will be just as safe for women.
Abortion is one of, if not the safest medical procedure there is. It's safer than getting your wisdom teeth out. It's safer than a colonoscopy. And so a lot of this outrage from the anti-abortion extremists about this license is really just disingenuous.
Lau says the clinic will offer medication abortions to women up to 10 weeks pregnant. She says in the future it may offer STD testing, contraception, and other services. The clinic is currently taking calls for appointments starting next week. Women's Care Center, a clinic that offers pregnancy verification but not abortion, is working to open a clinic across the street from the Whole Women's Health Alliance clinic. I'm Jennifer Weingart in South Bend.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Four women who say Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill groped them last year are suing Hill and the state in federal court. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on the lawsuit's claims of sexual harassment, discrimination, and retaliation.
State Representative Mara Candelaria Reardon, Gabrielle McLemore, Nikki DeSilva, and Samantha Lozano say Curtis Hill touched them inappropriately at a 2018 post-legislative session party. Hill denies those allegations. But the lawsuit goes far beyond that. It includes allegations of what's happened in the months since. That includes Hill going on the attack against his accusers and a claim that a female state senator told a colleague the women deserved what happened to them because of the way they were dressed. McLemore says the suit is about more than only Curtis Hill.
Ultimately, we're trying to find a way to help the Indiana State House become a safer workplace for everyone who works there.
The women want monetary damages and an apology from Hill and the state to create more robust sexual harassment and employee protection policies. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Indiana teacher whose job ended last year after he refused to use transgender students' preferred pronouns and names is suing his former district. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay reports the suit claims he was forced out of his position and the district violated his freedom of religious expression.
John Klug says his religious beliefs prevent him from using transgender students' preferred pronouns or names. And as a teacher at Brownsburg Community Schools, he says officials told him to follow a policy forcing him to use transgender students' preferred names or lose his job. The district has a non-discrimination policy that includes gender identity and says Klug resigned. Now, the Indiana Family Institute, a faith-based policy group, is joining Klug with a federal lawsuit alleging the district violated Klug's freedom of religion and First Amendment rights. The lawsuit is calling for the district to no longer enforce policies that violate an employee's religious beliefs, specifically about gender identity, and pay legal fees and back pay. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Archdiocese of Indianapolis will no longer recognize a Jesuit high school because its leaders refused to fire a teacher in a same-sex marriage. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports.
Brebeuf Jesuit principal Greg Van Slambrook says the Archdiocese told the school to dismiss a male teacher after his marriage became public, but the school refused.
We made our decision in this situation just in regards to our own community, our own teacher doing the right thing by him and by our community and its values, as opposed to with any eye on larger implications.
The Archdiocese will issue a decree Friday that says it no longer recognizes the school. In the past year, another Indianapolis Catholic high school suspended two guidance counselors because they're both in same-sex marriages. Brebeuf leaders say they'll appeal the decree. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Environmental Protection Agency has officially replaced an Obama-era rule that would have set limits on air pollution from coal-fired plants. The Trump administration says the Clean Power Plan, which never went into effect, was an overreach of the EPA's power. The new Affordable Clean Energy Rule allows states to set their own goals for greenhouse gas emissions. Environmentalists worry that with less federal oversight, the rule could lead to more air pollution-related deaths. 2 years ago, Indiana passed a law that said the state couldn't enact environmental rules more stringent than federal ones without a review. That could leave Indiana, a heavily coal-fired state, without a baseline to follow. States will have 3 years to submit their plans to reduce coal-fired emissions under the new rule.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Leadership at the state's largest teachers union is changing this summer. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports the incoming president says he plans to focus more on local schools' needs. Keith Gamble has been the Indiana State Teachers Association vice president for 6 years, and later this summer, he'll become president after members elected him this spring. He plans to prioritize time in education communities around the state, he says, to keep the union's strategies aligned with what's happening in public schools.
And any modifications that may need to be made from that is done in response to the needs of our members.
ISDA has pressed lawmakers for more public school funding and increases to teacher pay across Indiana, especially during this year's legislative session. Gamble says he wants to highlight the need for better pay for other school employees, too, and improving the state's school funding formula. Gamble takes office August 1st. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indianapolis-based Eli Lilly is challenging a new federal rule that would require drug companies to include prices in TV ads. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports Lilly joins two other drug companies in a recently filed lawsuit.
Reducing high drug prices is one of President Trump's priorities, and the move for more transparency through advertising was announced last year. The lawsuit comes before the rule is set to take effect next month. In it, Eli Lilly, Merck, and Amgen, along with the Association of National Advertisers, say the move violates the First Amendment. The suit also claims the rule could harm the health of patients who may choose not to take a medication based on list price. In the lawsuit, the companies say the rule would create confusion because patients do not usually pay the full price after insurance and other discounts are factored in. They also argue there are better ways for patients to estimate costs, including a pharmaceutical website where some companies voluntarily offer insight on out-of-pocket costs. The lawsuit names the Department of Health and Human Services, its secretary and former Eli Lilly leader, Alex Azar, as well as the offices of Medicaid and Medicare. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Just 13% of eligible registered Hoosier voters cast a ballot in May's municipal primaries. That's barely an improvement over the last municipal primary elections in 2015. The numbers don't include 23 counties that didn't have primary elections this year. Voter turnout in primaries is typically low. Only 1 in 5 Hoosiers cast a ballot in May of 2018, which featured a competitive U.S. Senate primary. And the presidential primary in May 2016 only drew a little more than a third of eligible voters to the polls. Martin and Rush counties posted the highest turnout this year, while Putnam and Tippecanoe counties came in the lowest with just 2% turnout.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
First responders will lead a series of public demonstrations ahead of an action-packed scheduled program dubbed as the Thrill Show this Saturday, June 22nd at the MAC campus from 12 p.m. to 3 p.m. Families will experience a thrilling live show with first responders' demonstrations on the techniques they must learn to save lives and keep us safe from the bad guys. Highlights of the day of events include a canine apprehension demonstration, a vehicle extraction demonstration, and so much more. The Multi-Agency Academic Cooperative Emergency Services Training Campuses, or MAC, is located at 4203 Montdale Park Drive in Valparaiso. Participants for the First Responder Thrill Show include Portage Police Department, Valparaiso Fire Department, Valparaiso Police Department, Indiana State Police, Burns Harbor Volunteer Fire Department, Porter County Emergency Management Services, Hobart Fire Department, and others. There is no cost to attend, but tickets are required. For more information, visit www.macthrillshow2019.eventbrite.com.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
More and more states are adopting so-called red flag laws in an attempt to curb gun violence. These laws allow police to confiscate guns in an emergency. Side Effects Public Media's Isaiah Seibert reports on a recent case in Indiana and its implications for mental health. Now, just a warning, this story contains material including talk of suicide that some listeners may find disturbing.
Earlier this year, police dispatchers in Evansville received a chilling call. A man said he was holding his wife at knife point and warned police that he was heavily armed.
I spent the last 2 days arguing my residence against police forced entry, and I'm armed at the teeth.
The threat to the man's wife wasn't real, and he was arrested for the improper 911 call. But local newscasts reported that he did have a lot of guns.
Evansville police say they seized nearly a dozen guns from a mentally unstable man's home.
To do that, the newscast said, police invoked a state law called
the Red Flag Law.
Red Flag Law.
Red Flag Law. Red Flag Law.
The law allows police to confiscate guns from people deemed dangerous. Sam Preston has seen it used before. He worked at the county sheriff's office for almost 30 years.
Quite often, what it looked like would be deputies were responding to someone who's in crisis. If there was weapons involved, they would take that opportunity to secure those weapons and take them with us.
Indiana's red flag law was passed in 2005, and it's one of the oldest in the country, but it isn't used a lot. Evansville police say this may be the first time for the department. Preston says he saw the sheriff's office use it about a half dozen times.
I don't think anyone wants to live in a country where people can have their weapons seized and taken away from them.
Preston calls himself a Second Amendment supporter and says the law strikes a good balance.
We also do have to protect the public, and just because someone in a moment in time may not be healthy enough for them to have a weapon doesn't mean that down the road that they won't be able to.
The red flag law doesn't require officers to obtain a warrant, but without one, police have to get a judge's permission to hold on to the weapons. Preston says judges almost always ruled in favor of law enforcement, but the gun owner can ask the court every 6 months to get the guns back.
Suicidal crises most of the time last a very short time.
Kent Leslie used to work for a local mental health center. He's taught classes on mental health issues to law enforcement, medical professionals, and the general community. That included training to prevent suicide by limiting access to guns. It boils down to this.
When somebody's at risk of dying by suicide, if we have some distance and time from the lethal means, it does save lives.
Leslie stresses that the vast majority of people with mental illnesses are not violent, and they are much more likely to be the victim of violence than to perpetrate it.
I see the person that has a mental illness or that may be at risk of dying by suicide as the center of a wagon wheel. And those spokes that surround that wagon wheel can help that person move forward. The more spokes, the better.
Leslie says that more than half of suicides in the United States involve a gun and that red flag laws can help. Even in a red state like Indiana, which recently hosted the NRA convention, laws like these enjoy bipartisan support.
It's common sense. We don't want dangerous individuals having access to guns. And if they do, we want to make sure that we find help for these individuals and that those weapons are taken away from them.
That's Republican State Representative Wendy McNamara. This year, she co-sponsored some changes to the Indiana law, and they passed almost unanimously. The new version allows state police to give the FBI the names of people who've had their guns taken away, and it's now a crime to supply a gun to those people. The changes come as other states turn to Indiana for guidance. Florida passed a red flag law following the school shooting in Parkland in February 2018. Colorado recently became the 15th state to pass a red flag law.
Indiana has been recognized because we were one of the originals having a red flag law, so a lot of people are looking to Indiana as they go and rewrite a lot of their laws on this type of process when it comes to taking away weapons from dangerous individuals.
Back in Evansville, a judge allowed police to keep the guns of the man who made the threatening 911 call. His case on the call is still pending, and his lawyers didn't respond to a request for comment. But Evansville police say the law worked just as it was meant to.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Natasha Scripture lost her father as well as herself in the search for finding the one. She was drained by her job at the United Nations and had come to a place in which she asked herself, what is her purpose? Natasha then embarked on a personal journey to find answers and set out to document it in her book, Manfast, a memoir, a book that was recently released in the U.S. The author recently spoke with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson to talk about her experience.
What is the takeaway in terms of life lessons and self-awareness that people can get for themselves from reading your book?
Well, that's an interesting and ambitious first question, but there's a lot. There's a lot in the book. I think, you know, part of what drove the book was that I wanted to share the richness and complexity of my experience as being a woman so far in my life, you know, up until my early 40s. But I think, you know, one of the big takeaways that I guess I should communicate and why the book is called Manfast is that I had spent so much time looking for that so-called one, you know, that soulmate, that I lost myself in the search for the one. And so one of the big epiphanies I had was that I am the one, there's no one, which sounds cliche, and of course it's all about self-love, but it really took me a while to kind of get to that place where I just, you know, could really see my life as happy and whole in the absence of a romantic relationship. So that was one of my big takeaways. I mean, there's so many different takeaways because, as you can see, the book is about so many different things. It's about grief. It's about being an aid worker.
What did it take you to get to that point, to come to that realization?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I really need to get away. So I left New York City, and I wanted to have some space to process through a lot of what I'd gone through. You know, like I said, I've been an aid worker for the UN. I've been traveling. I've been living a frantic life in New York City. And so I really need to disconnect from that world, and which is what I did. And I ended up kicking off my journey in India. I also really wanted to reconnect with nature. So a lot of what I did, all these little experiments that I write about in the book, which is I like to describe as an experiential memoir, they involved, you know, being in nature in some capacity. I was living in a jungle in Kerala in an ashram studying Ayurveda, which is a 5,000-year-old system of health and well-being from India. Then I was living on a vineyard in Mount Etna in Sicily, and I was working on that vineyard. I spent some time in the largest game reserve in southern Tanzania, and I, you know, basically went on a solo safari, and I married myself on a remote beach. So a lot of the book was like a journey inward, an escape from city life, an escape from pressure, the pressure to settle down and get married.
And what was the message that you wanted people to get out of the book?
Well, I think, you know, my whole approach was like, how could I design my life so I would be whole and happy in my own? You know, what did I want? You know, because women were always asking the world what we want and need, and we're always measuring against the masculine paradigm of success. But I wanted to look at things through a different lens and take that time to love myself in the way that I'd long to be loved, right? So a lot of my realizations were around the essence of love and the fact that, you know, I thought that I didn't have love in my life because I didn't have eros or so-called romantic love, or I had it, but I had it in snippets, you know, nothing that was that of any duration. But then when I really, you know, looked inward, I realized there was so much love in my life, right? Friends, communities, colleagues, spiritual love. There was all this. I really learned how to embody the different kinds of love in my life. Like the Greeks, you know, have so many different names for love. And I really, you know, started to look at things through that perspective, which I think is so much healthier than just fixating on, you know, Hollywood romantic love.
Right, right. I'm so sorry about the death of your father, by the way. I know that's one of the things that led you to write the book. What else do you want to tell us about what led you to write the book?
I think, you know, I just got to this point where I had been like on, you know, just go, go, go for so long that I'd had all these experiences, you know, I'd lived in all these different places and I'd met these just wonderful souls all over the world thanks to my work at the UN. And I wanted to share their stories and to share my experiences of meeting them, you know, living in a refugee camp and, you know, being in Swat Valley in Pakistan or being in Haiti after the earthquake. And I just felt I wanted to document those experiences and I wanted to find the meaning in them, because I didn't, you know, I never had time to do that. So, you know, it was liberating to be able to write about it. And, you know, also wanted to write about grief, because I know that I'm not the only one who's gone through, you know, grief. We all have different things that we're grieving. And, you know, I studied grief and I wrote about it in the book because I feel like, you know, the process of grieving is so, it's so individual, it's not linear. And I think, you know, I really wanted to make sense of that everybody has their own path towards healing, right? And then we have to accept that darkness in our lives and to understand that the, you know, more we grieve, the deeper we go, you know, it always gives us more than what we had because it breaks us open and it gets to the core of who we are. So I write a lot about that, which I think will resonate with people who've also lost loved ones.
Yeah.
You know, in a way, in the book, in Manfast, I'm inviting readers to be deep, you know, witnesses into my process of unfolding the truth around these big ideas like grief and resilience and women's empowerment and feminism and, you know, and then, of course, there's a lot of meditation. I mean, it's a very spiritual book.
Were you in such pain that this kind of came pouring out of you?
Yeah, you know, the first draft, I think I held back a little bit, and my editor was like, yeah, we need to see more blood on the page, and she's like, we can always edit it out later, and then I, you know, took another stab, and I really felt that it did pour out of me, and it felt really organic, and it was really healing to just have to write with such radical honesty. And in the end, we didn't edit out a lot of it. I mean, it is, a lot of it's pretty sad, as you might have noticed. But a lot of it, hopefully, is also humorous and inspiring and uplifting. So I tried to strike a balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It must have taken a lot of guts to do what you did. How did you work up the courage to go on that traveling journey?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, I love this definition of courage because the Latin root of courage is core, like C-O-R, which means heart. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think to be courageous means living with heart. And I felt like it was more a decision to live with heart, right? Like I didn't want to be in the same state that I was in forever. I knew I had to do some internal work and, you know, alchemize all these painful experiences and into wisdom to make sense of them, right? To find the meaning in the suffering, which is what Viktor Frankl said after the Holocaust, right? So how do we make...
Yeah, man's search for meaning.
Meaning in what we, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, how do we find the meaning in these experiences that we've had? And in the book, in Manfast, I really try... I have three missions, right? It's to inspire, empower, and educate, because I do feel like I've had a life of privilege in the sense that I've been able to travel so much and meet so many people from different walks of life, and I feel like it's my duty to almost to storytell around that.
How have you been able to do that? What gave you that life and that privilege?
I worked hard for it. I mean, I grew up obviously in, you know, a middle upper class bubble, going to good schools and all that stuff, but I, in terms of, you know, pursuing a career at the UN, I did all the right things. I worked hard to get into graduate school, and I learned some languages and networked and kept at it. And I do believe that if you want something badly enough, you just pursue it, it happens. It just doesn't happen on your timeline. I mean, it took many, many years. So I really was committed to it and really, you know, was leaning into my career a lot in my 20s and 30s.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Purdue University economist Larry DeBoer.
Related to school referenda, let's check in with Purdue University agricultural economist and Indiana taxation policy expert Larry DeBoer. Larry is on the West Lafayette campus, and thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, you mentioned that and there are several ways, I guess, that that school referenda seem to be set up. And you mentioned that there's five different hypothetical cases, I guess, or trends, I suppose. Go through these, if you will, and how do they seem to work out here as far as what happened back in the May primary elections this year?
Yeah, well, I do keep track of the trends that are going on, and I sometimes call them hypotheses when I'm feeling scientific. So every time we get a new election here, May and November, we have these school referenda elections. We get to test the hypotheses again or see if the trends are holding up. So the first one is that there's a trend towards a greater percentage of these referenda passing. You know, when we started out back in 2009, 10, and 11, less than half of the referenda were passing. But we got to 2016, 17, and early 18, and we were getting 80 and 90%, and one time 100% of them passing. That's not holding up. Back in November, only two-thirds passed, and this time, 6 out of 10 passed. And so for a May election, that was, in fact, the lowest percentage passing since 2011. So the upward trend seems not to be holding up. So that hypothesis, let's call it trend.
Yeah.
That trend not holding up. Another one is that historically, May referenda have done better than November referenda. But that also didn't hold up. As I said, this May was the lowest passing rate since 2011, and it was actually lower than the passing rate in November, last November, which was 67%. So 60% this time, 67% last time. So that one didn't hold up. One of them that did, though, was that school corporations trying for the first time, for the first referendum, didn't do as well as those that have tried before and are trying a second or a third or even a fourth time. And this time we had two of the four rookies losing, whereas four out of six veterans won. Mm-hmm. And so a greater percentage of veterans won. But still, it was a little surprising because the folks who have actually tried and won before didn't do quite as well. There were two school corporations, Elkhart and in Lake County, Hanover, that actually passed referenda before that failed this time, and that used to be very unusual, but now we've seen it a couple of times. I think the Hanover case is kind of interesting. They passed their referendum in May 2015. It was an operating referendum for just general purposes, and they asked for 29 cents and got a 54% yes vote. And this time for a capital project, they asked for 56 cents, so nearly double, and got 48% yes. So it was close, but, you know, it's kind of, it strikes me as kind of plausible that asking for 27 cents more could have reduced the yes vote by 6 percentage points, and as it happens, that puts you from above 50 to below 50 and from a win to a loss.
I note that, that you're talking, too, about Lake County. I also noted, too, that the Lake Forest River Forest School Corporations had asked for an increase, and that was one of those, I understand, that did make it through this time.
It did. And, you know, that's the next hypothesis is that referenda asking for higher rates don't tend to do as well as referenda asking for lower rates. And you know, the Hanover case sort of illustrates that, asking for a considerably higher rate this time, and they didn't win compared to the last time they tried. But that sort of held up this time. If you rank the rates from highest to lowest of the 10, the five lowest, 4 out of 5 passed. And of the 5 highest, only 2 out of 5 passed. But the lowest rate that was asked for was Plymouth over in Marshall County. They asked for 19 cents, and they lost, only got 36% yes. Whereas River Forest asked for $1.19, and they got a 57% yes vote. And that is the highest tax rate ever passed in a referendum.
Wow.
So, you know, looking at that thing, I would have guessed that the chances were pretty slim. But no, 57% yes for River Forest on a very high rate.
Does it just seem that it depends only anymore on what the questions happen to be? Whether they're when you're asking for a tax rate to cover things like safety equipment for schools, or if you're looking at transportation costs or things like that?
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, I've got these trends that hold up more or less over time, but they certainly don't explain the results. These are very much local elections. And all kinds of things matter. There's research out there others have done that show that the popularity of the superintendent can matter in terms of passing or not. One of the consultants tells me that whether there's a mayoral primary going on or not can make a difference. Sometimes the referendum issue gets sucked into the mayoral race, and that can influence the results. And certainly the things, what you're asking for matters. And of course, in Lake County, you've got many of the school corporations asking for additional levies, additional rates, looking ahead to the additional losses in tax cap credits that they're going to experience next year. And I think that may have had something to do with River Forest's high rate ask there.
Let's talk a little bit about that. We know that we've been lucky in Lake County and in St. Joseph County. South Bend has been in the same boat, so to speak, that we've had the property tax caps in place for a number of years since they were enacted, 10 years ago? And now the tax caps are going to expire. Are we finding, as best as we can tell, that local governments are ready for, or are they still preparing for the shock and the changes that are going to happen as a result when the caps leave?
Well, I think we're going to see. So what happened is we voted the tax caps into the Constitution back in 2010. And in the Constitution, two counties were given exceptions. And they weren't named in the Constitution, but there were criteria set up. And Lake County and St. Joe County, where South Bend is, were the only two that qualified. And the idea there was that the tax caps were going to limit or put a maximum on the amount of property taxes that a taxpayer could pay. And in counties where rates were very high, the losses of revenue to local governments were going to be very big. And so Lake and St. Joe were going to see very large losses. Now, they did see very large losses, but the Constitution gave them an exception, said that the existing debt service property taxes used to pay back bonds for big capital projects, those existing debt service tax rates would be exempt from the tax caps, whereas in the other 90 counties they were included. And that meant that there were several millions of dollars in each of those counties that could be collected and that the taxpayers had to pay. Well, the Constitution said you got 10 years, basically, to adjust, and the time's up in 2020. And so the budgets that they will be making, that all the local units in Lake and St. Joe will be making this for 2020, starting here pretty quick, are going to have less revenue available. And I guess I don't have a good sense as to whether the units of government have adjusted very well or not. I think we'll find out when the budget process is finished here. But those counties that have managed, those school corporations that have managed to pass referenda may be in better shape.
I wonder if this will bode well or perhaps not bode well at all for the school districts that that tried but they failed to get referenda passed in recent years. And in particular, I keep thinking of ones like Lake Ridge School Corporation, which is in Calumet Township in Lake County. They tried. They had a very ambitious campaign underway. The voters in the Calumet Township did not at all agree in the referenda questions, and so the measures failed. And I don't know for sure. Of course, I know the school district is, from the latest information, they're trying to prepare for it. They've already decided they have to close one elementary school. They only have two in the district. They have to close one of them now and keep the biggest one open and shift all the youngsters over to that school. And they're still trying to deal with the concerns that I know they have on their transportation program. They're in a township that basically has hardly any, if any at all, sidewalks for youngsters to walk to school. So those youngsters are going to have to either walk in the road or walk alongside the road, or they have to get rides to school. And the buses are the only way that they can get the youngsters in, but that's one of the problems I know that probably not only Lake Ridge, but other school corporations run into.
That is true, and Lake Ridge is in a particularly difficult situation. One thing that folks ought to know about the tax caps is that what counts is the rate that the taxpayer pays. And so Lake Ridge could have a very reasonable property tax rate and still lose a lot of revenue to the tax caps if the overlapping units, the city and the county and so forth, have high rates. So there's not much that Lake Ridge can do to reduce their tax cap losses on their own. It's really a problem of all of the local units in that area. And so, you know, they asked for two $1 rates, construction referendum and an operating referendum back in November, and lost. And now they've got to do something else. Now they've got to make the adjustments for the losses that are upcoming.
Will there be any opportunities in the future, once here in Lake and in St. Joseph County also, to be able for school districts to be able to come back to the voters and ask for referenda? Will they just have to be a bit more careful on how much they ask for, as if they ask for any increases, because we'll still be dealing with the increases because the tax caps have been lifted?
Oh yeah, you can. If you lose, you can come right back in another year and try again. And there's plenty of examples of school corporations. In fact, I took a look at this data. I found 16 different school corporations that lost and then tried again within 2 years, and 9 out of 16 won the second time. And so I think the experience of losing and the adjustments that they make in the referenda that they ask for makes a difference. And so they run a better campaign. They ask for lower rates. They advertise to the voters a little better, and maybe the voters think again, and they tend to win. So second time around, much better results often in our history here.
I'm not sure if I've asked the question before in our previous conversations when we talk about this, the school districts having referenda vote, going to the taxpayers in their particular school district asking for help. We mentioned and we noticed before that there are a number of consultants that are out there apparently helping out, or maybe there aren't very many as far as the number of companies or individuals that are helping school districts set these campaigns up. Are we finding that there are more of them out there? Do we get more school corporations now that are going to be looking for referenda votes from their residents?
Well, I think it's pretty standard now for school corporations to hire a consultant. Early on, 2009 in particular, I think people had had, or school corporations had had, the experience of the old petition remonstrance process and kind of figured, hey, we put this thing on the ballot, it passes, and off we go. And boy, they were shocked at how many didn't get through early on. And I think they realized that this is a campaign. This is a political campaign, and you need political campaign consultants if you really want to run it right. And so I think that this is very widespread, that they raise a little money, of course, outside the budgets of the school corporations in order to pay for a campaign with a consultant.
I'm not sure if we are going to see anything come up here in the November general election, since we've had all these referenda that have all come up here in the primary election season, so to speak. If we have of any word or any indication that there will be school corporations out there that will try, even though maybe not as successfully in November as they seem to have in May, but they're going to try this fall to ask the voters for help.
Yeah, I haven't seen a list yet, and I don't know that the paperwork is completed so that the list would show up yet. But I'm certain there will be some. And I was at a school meeting last week, and I seem to remember hearing that, in fact, there may be quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a new test. Well, coming up of the hypotheses.
Well, that'll be in November will be the time, and before the November general election will definitely be the time where we're going to find here that idea about the conflict between the city government races and the school district out there trying to vie for the voters' attention for a referendum vote too. Larry, thank you very much for spending some time and taking a look at these questions, and we'll have of course you back for other topics as well too. But we'll look ahead for what's happening in November if any school districts decide to seek referendum vote. Thank you for being with us on the program today.
Anytime, Chris.
Larry DeBoer is a professor in agricultural economics and also studies Indiana taxation policy, and he's based out of Purdue University in West Lafayette. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana University Northwest is inviting all incoming fall semester enrolled freshmen to get a jump start in their college experience through the Summer Bridge Program. It begins on August 19th and it runs through the 23rd. It's a free program and it will be from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Monday through Thursday, and from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Friday. And we should mention also, by the way, on that Friday session, a dinner will be provided. And I had a chance to talk with Associate Professor in Geology, Chris Heiskin, today about this program and how it's going to help new IU Northwest students. How long has it been going on, by the way? This is not the first year, is it?
It's not the first year of the bridge, but...
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by bensound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.